So the association with the magazine was a very fortunate happenstance, and
and the society of the plastics industry as well, which
that was organized about that same time, 37. They're celebrating their 50th anniversary this year. And I met, for example, Leo Bakeland, the discoverer of Bakelite, Redman, who was one of the head of the, one of the two competitors for Bakelite, which amalgamated into the Bakelite Corporation. And met Dr. Pollock, who discovered urea formaldehyde. He came to visit us in Bethesda. The so I was able to have these contacts with the very sundry individuals.
Was Bakeland still active in his company when you met him, or had he pretty much retired from it?
Well, he was nominally head of the company, but his son was really, I'm sure, doing the work. He was a very interesting individual. I had many contacts with him, particularly at the Gordon Research Conferences, which were being held just outside of Baltimore back in the 30s, and he was very talkative in those days, and interested in exploring what was going on, and so he invited us to, when we came to Miami, we visited Miami in 1940, in December, he invited us to his estate in Carl Gables, which he had purchased from William Jennings Bryan, and he had a yacht there which he called the Ion, and he had palm trees all over this estate, which had been sent, or trees, not just palm trees, which had been sent by the various affiliates of the Bakelite Corporation all from all over the world. And he took us around, showed us these various trees, and had comments on some of them. And Charlie Parsons was the secretary of the American Chemical Society, our chief executive, well, I think his title was secretary at that time, and he said this was the Charlie Parsons tree because it was built with a rather large structure, as Charlie Parsons was. And spoke of him being very talkative at the Gordon Research Conferences. We used to go swimming in the afternoon, if you happened to run into Dr. Bakeland when you're on your way to a swim, you had to, I wouldn't say resign yourself, but maybe have the opportunity of talking with him for 1 hour before you got along with your swim. But of course it was a privilege to hear what he had to say, and to have known him. Roy Keenly was another individual who was associated with General Electric Company and very active in the development of what were known as alkyd resins, polyesters. He attended those Gordon Research Conferences. Dr. Carver from Eastman Kodak, there were a good many of them. And Tom Midgley, who discovered or was the inventor, I don't know what they call it, inventing a chemical compound, but anyway, he was the had the patent on the tetraethyl lead. So individuals of that type were at these polymer conferences, the Gordon Research. Dr. Gordon was a professor at Johns Hopkins University, and was, although he never actually did any research in the field of polymers, he was a very active organizer and interested in developments in chemistry.
How did you see your role at once you had become technical editor of Modern Plastics and you'd met people in the industry and you were working at the Bureau of Standards, head of the plastics section and then plastics division? How did you see your role?
Well,
as
between
government agencies, I mean, like the military agencies and the companies. And
I always was very careful to avoid any conflict of interest. Subsequently, there were other magazines that came into the field. In the field of plastics, and I always tried to give them equal access to any articles that they might be interested in publishing in their journals as well as in Modern Plastics. The and the it really it was a lot of all of the work for Modern Plastics was done outside of office hours. There was none of the work did I do at the Bureau. I did that after hours or weekends, and which turned out to be quite a burden at that time, moonlighting. But of course, one advantage was it practically doubled my salary. It was always the question whether I would have remained at the Bureau of Standards if I hadn't had that second source of income. Before the war started, the publishers of Modern Plastics had asked me, in fact talked me into going to Modern Plastics as the editor of the magazine. And I went up to the director, Dr. Briggs, and asked him, told him about this offer, and Dr. Briggs was a fine gentleman and very even-tempered, and very slow and deliberative in what he said. But he became very red in the face and pounded the table. Said, "Who is this that is robbing the National Bureau of Standards of its plastics expert in this time of great need," which of course was in 41, and I said, "Well, Dr. Briggs, you gave me permission to be technical editor of Modern Plastics, and if you want me to remain at the Bureau of Standards during this period," of course the war hadn't started yet for us at that time, but I said, "I will remain as long as you feel that I am needed here." And so that's the way it was left. Of course, in the meantime, during the war, I had made many contacts abroad and had some very unusual experiences during the the surveys that were made in Germany just toward the end of the war. So I had reached the conclusion by the time the war ended that I was not interested in becoming the editor of Modern Classics. I was still willing to handle the technical side, but that I realized that the science and editorship of the Modern Classics were in conflict, and Mr. Breskin himself, I think, realized it because he never asked me at the end of the war to fulfill that commitment. But I was also asked by a firm, U.S. Rayon, to come, this was at the end of the war, to be director of research for the company, mm-hmm. laboratory. And what was the magnificent sum of $25,000 a year at that time, when of course my government salary was still of the order of half that. And I considered it, of course, I wasn't considering it on the basis of the government salary because of, as I say, the income from technical editorship brought it to approximately the same figure.
Uh-huh.
And so I declined, and thanked them for the consideration of me as a candidate. But what happened was then Dr. Broussan, Herman Broussan of Roman Haas, who was very famous for his various inventions, patents for basic resins. He was their outstanding chemist in the Roman Haas laboratories. Became director of research for the U.S. Rayon with a $50,000 a year, 5-year contract. But at the end of the 5 years, he was no longer director. So there's always that hazard in accepting offers of that type. I wasn't the least bit interested in bargaining mm-hmm. for any more. A little later, in Harry Truman's time as president, there was some congressional action or some departmental regulation, I think would be a better word for it, regarding conflict of interest. And Truman had put up some sort of a statement regarding avoiding conflict of interest for government employees. So I wrote a 2-page memorandum to the director of the Bureau stating the fact that I had been technical editor of Modern Classics since 1936, and in view of the fact that that these new regulations had been issued, I wanted to again have the department, not just the Bureau of Standards, but the Department of Commerce, approve my continuation as technical editor of Modern Plastics, which work I was doing outside of regular hours,
mm-hmm.
and received the approval, fortunately. So. I think the record was clear that the two were compatible. In fact, Julius Klein, who was Secretary of Commerce at the time that I first became technical editor, subsequently visited me at the National Bureau of Standards on business for one of his clients and said that his policy had always been that there should be as much contact with the industry from the Department of Commerce side as possible, because that's after all fitting from the name of the department. The Department of Commerce, the department was there to work with industry. So,
did you say before the war, did you do work for industry? I mean, could they use the Bureau or your section as a kind of research organization, or or did you take up problems that seemed to be of general interest that they had brought to you? Or
we primarily in the plastics field, better than 50% of our funds came from other government agencies. That was, as long as I was at the Bureau of Standards, both in charge of plastics and subsequently in charge of the division, was essentially based on at least 50% of the budget coming from other government agencies, not from industry. The Bureau of Standards did have a beginning program on research associates from industry, but there were never any from industry while I was there, as far as our work was concerned. No, our work was primarily divided into two parts. The work supported by the Bureau was on fundamental research, and we became known at the time I retired as the leading plastics laboratory in the country, both in the way of the work we were doing and the publications that we were, the scientific reports that we were publishing. Now, of course, later on, the university laboratories in plastics sprung up. Princeton had a laboratory, and of course, Brooklyn Polytech under Herman Mark. But at that time, in the 60s, as I say, our advisory committee did present us with the compliment that work was certainly one of the leading laboratories.
This is the afternoon of May 15th, and I'd like to ask first about what it meant to you, what you were able to do because of your role as head of the organic plastics section at the National Bureau of Standards, and at the same time being technical editor of Modern Plastics. What was that, a unique kind of situation, or what were you able to do in those two positions together?
Yeah, well, it was unique in the sense that at that time there was only the one magazine covering the plastics field in the United States, and it gave me the opportunity to disseminate to industry in a broader fashion through publishing the results of our research on plastics to the industry as a whole. The situation back in the middle 30s was such that when I became technical editor in June 1936, there were very few articles sent directly to Modern Plastics from industry sources for publication. The situation was that most of the firms felt that their research was proprietary information and that they were not interested in visiting, in publishing the results of their research that would benefit the other firms. And in one of the early issues after my taking on the editorship was to exhort the executives of plastics industry to recognize that they would benefit by having such information made available in the literature, because they would learn as much from what other people were doing that would be of sufficient benefit to them to warrant them doing the same. The otherwise there would be duplication, triplication of a great deal of the research that was going on. But it was several years before the industry came to this realization. There was a publication by the American Chemical Society about that same time that expressed the same viewpoint in a survey of plastics up to that point. They said in their survey that most of information regarding plastics was in the patent literature rather than in the scientific or trade literature, and that we found to be very true. Well, of course, that meant that from 1936 until about 1939 or 40, that as technical editor, I had the responsibility for either soliciting articles from from the commercial laboratories, or preparing the results of our research at the National Bureau of Standards and publishing those results in Modern Plastics. Of course, this was advantageous from the relationship of getting out information on what the Bureau of Standards was doing in plastics research, but it, as I say, that one-way street was not too beneficial to the industry as a whole. I remember on one of my, when I was first appointed chief of the plastics section, I made a trip around to the laboratories of the various major firms at that time, and this meant only visiting roughly 9 or 10 laboratories.
Mm-hmm.
In one of those laboratories, I was met by a administrative executive of the firm, and I asked him, I told him that there had been a plastic section formed at the Bureau of Standards. We were interested in telling their chemists what we were doing, and we would be very much interested in having them publicize some of their work in the field of plastics in the magazine. And to my surprise, the administrative executive said, "We do not allow any visitors to talk to our chief chemist." And so I never did get to see or talk to a chemist. I talked to only those individuals that were strictly on the business side.
Which company was this?
I'm trying to remember. It's no longer in existence. Let me say that it was not one of them. It was not one of the major chemical companies, but it was not typical. But even some firms in those days were reluctant to send their leading chemists to scientific meetings for fear that they would tell something to a competitor over a drink that that the firm felt was proprietary information.
But was that one of the reasons for the reluctance? I think there was a reluctance of firms to join in the SPI when it was formed. Did that have to do with the same kinds of issues?
Of course, the SPI was organized in 1937. It was purely a social organization up to that point. The executives of the industry, and because of my position as technical editor of Modern Plastics, in those early days, I was invited to attend those meetings as a representative of Modern Plastics, but there was very little discussion at those early meetings of what was going on in the way of technical research in their laboratories. It was mostly on the business side and the social side. So it wasn't really until about that same time, the American Chemical Society organized a plastics group, and the ASTM organized a plastics committee, and this brought together these two organizations, brought the chemists and the mechanical engineers from these firms together in preparation, either in preparation of standard methods of test or in the discussion of technical research, so that after those organizations came into existence, the exchange of information began to flow in a much better and beneficial way.
You played a role in founding the ASTM Plastics Committee, didn't you?
Yes. I have the record of the formation of the ASTM Committee. There was an organization meeting held at the Waldorf Astoria. We started out very high class, and that was on July 1, 1937. Most of the work on synthetic resins and plastics had been done by ASTM Committee D9 on electrical insulating materials. But by 1937, of course, the materials of the industry were going into much broader industrial fields, and it was felt that the time had come that methods of tests should be standardized. That first meeting resulted in the recommendation that the committee, ASTM Committee D20 on Plastics, be organized, and recommended that five subcommittees be organized covering strength properties, hardness properties, thermal properties, optical properties, and permanence properties. And they appointed the chairman for these five subcommittees. Because of our work that was going on at the Bureau of Standards on the permanence, on the weathering of plastics and resistance to chemicals and so forth, they asked me to serve as chairman of the permanence properties subcommittee. Then a meeting was, the second meeting took place on October 27th, 1937, at the Hotel New Yorker in New York, and it was with that meeting that the real work on the preparation of standard testing methods started. And I have a copy of the minutes of that meeting, as well as the organization meeting. And those minutes ran to 14 pages, so quite a good deal was accomplished during I think it was a one-day meeting.
Mm-hmm.
And but Mr. Emley, who was chief of the division of organic and fibrous materials at the Bureau of Standards, served as chairman of D20 at that time, at the beginning. And the work in those five fields that I've just mentioned began. Of course, ASTM proceeds with the deliberation to arrive at a consensus on